Okay, good evening, everybody. Shavua Tov. So I always get inspired, and so I'll just start with that, when people come out on a Saturday night and this is what they want to do. It's something which is a great thing about the KJ community. It's something that's great about the Lincoln Square Synagogue community. It's good to have such a good chevra from our learning back on the West Side days, which feel like a while ago, but really actually were not. This lecture is sponsored by the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals. I'm its national scholar. This is the mic problem. The only way to do it is if I start with a funny thing happened to me on the way. That's the only way it'll. No matter what the angle, you basically must speak directly into the microphone, or it is as though it's not here. So that's the way that's going to be. I will try doing it this way, which means I'm not going to be able to talk with one of my hands at any given time, and that's hard to do. The Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals, which was founded by my father in 2007, we're getting close to our 10th anniversary now, its whole job is to promote diversity of opinion within the Orthodox community. That's something that all of you already know and love, but not everybody does, and increasingly we find that that isn't always the case within the Orthodox world, and we think that that is a problem. And we think that we have some good approaches to how to go about doing it. We have programs running all over the country. We have our journal called Conversations. The whole purpose of the title of our journal is to say there isn't one right way within the spectrum of Orthodoxy. We want to keep the conversations going. We're coming up to issue number 27 already, which is really very cool. And so they continue to come out 3 times a year. We have a university network where we want college students to be able to do that as well. I run a bunch of teacher trainings throughout the country where the goal is just to try to get faculties, Jewish studies faculties, to think about what will happen when your students go to college. Very often high school faculties are thinking about how to deal with high school students, which is a good thing to think about if you are a high school teacher, but they're not always looking beyond at the next step, and to me that's an important step. So I try to give some picture on here's what they're going to be hearing when they get to college, here's how we should be thinking about creating a program. All of these things together are what the Institute are about. Those of you who are members already, thank you for being members. To learn more about our Institute, please go to our website. Every single one of my source sheets is always with my business card. I have real business card looking things also, but I always prefer to do it through the context of actual learning. Also want to thank KJ, of course. I'm a rabbinic scholar, and so it's the partnership that we've created over the last year and a half where I work here at KJ, and it has become the home base for all of our Institute activities. I also want to thank the sponsors of the evening. I've noticed, I don't remember if this was true last year. As of last year, this thing was still called History at Home, but now it is officially called, so I can see in the boldface type in the handouts this morning, History at Home and Dessert. That's now an official part of the lecture program, which I don't think was true last year. Maybe I missed it. But in the meantime, I thank the sponsors for the dessert piece, which I believe is hiding under those tablecloths back there as a way of saying, learn first, munch later, which is a good message. And I'm sure we'll get there. The Dinah story, which we're going to do tonight, again, before we even start, there are source sheets on the chair over there. I have some more if we're running low. There's definitely enough for everybody. I just want to make sure that we actually have them. The Dinah story is really horrible. The fact that you've taken a Saturday night to learn this story in particular is even braver of you. My daughters, of course, who are 5, we discuss the parasha every day, or we discuss really Tanakh every day, and we just call it parasha. Right now we're in the book of Daniel, which isn't Parashat HaShavua anymore. But all the same, we just call it parasha, and at some point I'll try to clarify for them. Dinah is their favorite child of Yaakov for the simple reason that she is the girl. And they're 5, so they don't know the story that we're going to do, because there are certain things you just need to skip at certain points in a kid's education. This definitely is one of them. It's a horrible story. And the purpose of tonight is really to go through it with you. I hope that there will be some give and take. That's how I like to learn. And at the same time to try to figure out, okay, what is the Torah trying to teach regarding this tremendously horrible story? The short form of it is that Jacob's daughter Dinah goes to a Canaanite town. I mean, they live there. Now she goes and wanders off by herself, and it's confusing if you've never read the story before. The city and the main bad protagonist are both the same name. It's Shechem. And Shechem, the person who happens to be the son of the mayor of Shechem, the town, rapes Dinah. Seems to also keep her captive afterwards, but then, romantic that he is, sick guy, he falls in love with her and wants to marry her. And so Dinah has no voice at all in this story, and she is suddenly just a victim of a terrible situation. And the menfolk have to kind of work it all out, where Jacob and his sons have to come up with, quote-unquote, a solution to an already horrible problem. What do you do? rape, and now this guy wants to marry her. What should we do in this circumstance? And the rest of the story unfolds with a negotiation and eventually a massacre of the town. And our job, through all these terrible things which just keep getting worse, is to try to unlock what is the story trying to teach us? What is the living Torah trying to give to us? So without further ado, we will go. And again, feel free to make things happen. Now Dina, I'm doing it in English, of course, but I think it's always better for a general audience. There will be times that a Hebrew word or two will be thrown in because they're absolutely necessary for the learning. Now Dinah, the daughter whom Leah had borne to Jacob, went out to visit the daughters of the land. Recently, Jacob had bought land in Shechem. It's the first time that the people of Israel as a family ever bought land in the land of Israel for living people. Right? Prior, Abraham had bought a grave, a cemetery at Hebron for Sarah and eventually for him and the rest of the family. Here they now have land in Shechem. Verse 2, Shechem, son of Hamor the Hivite, chief of the country, saw her and took her and lay with her by force. So this is the rape part. And then suddenly it becomes the romantic part. Being strongly drawn to Dinah, daughter of Jacob, and in love with the maiden, he spoke to the maiden tenderly. So Shechem said to his father Hamor, get me this girl as a wife. So he goes from being this sick, horrible guy to now saying, I kind of like her. I think I would like to spend the rest of my time with her and raise children with her, and she'll just become part of the nobility of Shechem. So far, the horror has been done, and in no time fled. We're only up to verse 4. Jacob heard that he had defiled his daughter Dinah. How did he know about this? She didn't come home. Okay, but still, she might just be at a 20% off sale somewhere and taking too long. How does he know that this, what we read, happened? He doesn't have the Torah in front of him. Evidently, everybody knows, right? This is an important detail. It's not just that there's a private rape and now a private discussion between Shechem and his father Hamor. It's obvious that the town knows and is all abuzz. So Jacob finds out, not by, you know, Dinah didn't text by 10 o'clock, is that he hears the story. He hears what you and I just read. Very often we, the reader, know way more than the characters. But in this case, everybody's on board. Everybody knows what's going on. So here's the patriarch of the family. Keep in mind that his children are ballpark teenagers or so, probably a few even younger than that. Okay, he hears it. But since his sons were in the field with his cattle, Jacob kept silent until they came home. All right, so I'll ask you, and if you know the story, this is going to interfere with your ability to read this verse. What do you think Jacob is going to do when his sons come home? Yeah, okay, so he's going to go out there and do something about it. Okay, good, what else? Yeah? Correct. They may not know. And I agree with that. They very well may not know. The question is, though, Jacob here is waiting till his sons come home before he does anything. So I'm asking you, what do you think he will do when his sons come home? So one possibility is get everybody together and do something really, you know, let's get these guys. Huh?
He's going to explode.
He's going to explode. Okay, good. That's fair enough, right?
He's going to talk. You don't have to assume that he has to.
Okay, I mean, I hope that he is, but you're right. We don't know what his mood is on this particular matter. You're for sure right. Certainly talk about it, okay? Huh? It's certainly possible. It might be that he's expecting, why is she off by herself? What are you guys doing? Like, somebody should be making sure that she is involved, as opposed to running off alone in a pretty dangerous town.
I want to encourage guys. Get her. Take her back.
Okay, that's another. We got to get her out of here, right? Yeah, there's definitely a rescue. In other words, there's different components here. You might have an element of revenge, which I think you were driving at, right? You might have an element of, look, revenge ain't going to work. They're a big town and we're just a bunch of teenagers. It's not. We don't have an attack plan. But at least let's figure out a way to get our daughter, or my daughter, your sister, out of there. And let's sell the house and let's move to a safer place. Or something along those lines, yeah?
Does Jacob know that the rapist wants to make her a wife?
I don't know. It's a good question. I don't know how far his knowledge goes. We still might know more than he. But he at least knows about the defiled part.
Because my main question is, because of halakha, stone gets raped, then you pay silver to the father to make a wife. So if he does know about that, maybe he's getting ready for marriage.
Right, so you're invoking an important law which appears in the book of Deuteronomy. The risk of your interpretation is that, of course, the Torah has not been given yet. Right? Which means that he doesn't know that law. He was saying that there's a law later on, if there's a rape situation, then there's a monetary fine, and the rapist marries the woman, and then halakha tells you, assuming that the woman consents, she's allowed to say no. But if she says yes, then that's it. The plan A is to go for the marriage. In this case, though, Jacob is not bound by that law because the law is not given yet. So I don't know what conventions he's following at this point. It might be that he deems it a good idea for them to get married because she might have been viewed as defiled goods, and this is her best shot at a shidduch, right? It plausibly could be that Jacob at this point might be angry at the man, but it's the best option for Dinah. We just don't know. Okay. It's important to think about this question because when you know the story, sometimes knowledge is a good thing. I'm all pro-knowledge. But often knowledge really devastates your ability to learn. It's very, very difficult to read a story for the first time if it really isn't the first time. I always try to pretend to the extent possible that it is. So here we go. We're up to verse 6. Then Shechem's father Hamor came out to Jacob to speak to him. So here you go, patriarch to patriarch, right? So it's the father of the potential groom talking to the father of the potential bride. Meanwhile, Jacob's sons, having heard the news, came in from the field. Meaning they heard the buzz from somewhere else. They didn't even learn it from their father. Everybody's talking about this. The men were distressed and very angry, because he had committed an outrage in Israel by lying with Jacob's daughter, a thing not to be done. All right. So what's Jacob's mood in all of this? We don't know. We don't know anything about Jacob's mood. What's the brother's mood? They're furious. And in fact, here's just a nice little bonus. The narrative throws in what we just said at the end, a thing not to be done. You know, you hear the outrage of the text, which very plausibly is not the brother speaking anymore, but rather the narrative chiming in. Yeah, it really is an outrage. In case, dear reader, in case you don't know the Torah's values on rape, it's dead against it. The Torah was very progressive. It actually, later on in the law that you mentioned, likens rape to murder. It doesn't have the same penalties. But just in terms of the moral sense of the Torah, that back then, to deem rape a form of murder, because it's obviously, you know, a terrible violation, the Torah has a horror relationship with rape. And here we see it as well. Yeah.
What about the first line, to visit the daughters of the land? You said a little something about that, but could you say a little more? What is she doing? And what does that mean, the daughters of the land?
It could be. The answer is we don't. Sorry, what? Oh, repeat the question. What's up with verse 1 where it says that she went out to visit the daughters of the land? I don't know. Maybe she was looking for the current styles in the Shechem area and this was the place to go. I really don't know. There's no clear sense of what she was... Why did he not go out in the first place? It sounds like she was going to browse something. Mother merchandise, culture, style, I don't know. The Torah doesn't give a lot of emphasis on that, because the point is now she's all alone in a terrible neighborhood, and then the rest of the story unfolds, and that's where it goes. Yeah.
But that first sentence suggests that there really are social relationships. You go out to visit people with whom you have a relationship.
Absolutely, and there's no question. Look, our patriarchs interacted with the Canaanites. The usual mode, which is important, is that typically they took the approach of tent-dwelling nomads out of town, who then did business with the townsfolk. Right? They did not live in isolation. There were relationships between the patriarchs and the Canaanites. But at the same time, they always were insider-outsiders. They never wanted to integrate with the Canaanites because they despised them. They thought they were horribly immoral people. Right? I mean, the biggest heartbreak in the whole Torah pretty much is when Esav marries a couple of Canaanites and it just breaks his parents' hearts. It's like, you know, everything we've tried to teach you on all those years of yeshiva day school tuitions and this! You know, and that's the one thing that they tried to inculcate, because the Canaanites were horrible people. So you still do business with them because you're sharing the land, But simultaneously, they did not want to integrate with them.
In the Hebrew, does it say, "V'lode asen davar kazeh"? Is that similar to the phrase that Laban says to Jacob that you can't take me
out of the world? The phrase "V'lode asen" is a classic. It's a way of saying, we just don't do this. This is absolute taboo.
But then maybe there's a reference here for also for Jacob's silence, because he knows that there's a certain falsehood.
Very good. So I want to drive with your observation in just a little while. We're going to get back to that general point, yeah?
It's
so cool that I'm not pinned down by the mic. Thank you for suggesting I just hold it. Yeah, okay.
Simply as the later editorialized here, where you have the word Israel used for the word Israel, and then the event at the end, the thing not to be done, was very described, Laban and Jacob's daughter, period. And then a thing not to be done. So it's a very strong editorial position. It looks like it's being taken later in the story, later amendment.
But that is correct. In other words, you're exactly right. The Torah is speaking as the Torah in that line, rather than quoting the characters. So that's the whole point. In other words, the Torah here belies, so to speak. Here is a narrative given to Moshe that's telling a story about people who lived centuries earlier. So it's quoting them. Obviously, I assume that this is all paraphrased also. But then you get a sense of, oh, there's a narrative beyond the characters in play. Okay, good. So on those happy notes, what we have here, just to summarize what we have, I have no idea what Jacob is feeling at all, and neither do you, and neither does anybody. It's amazing that the father is utterly silent. In verse 5, when I asked you, he was waiting for his sons to come back so they could discuss it, and the sons come back, and they're bursting at the seams with rage. This is a horror. We need to do something about it, right? But we don't know if Jacob feels the same way. Right? He is remarkably silent, both in the text, but also the mood of Jacob is not conveyed by the narrator. Your point about dividing between narrator and characters is very important. Yeah.
If you look at the chronology of what's happening in the events, first if you say Jacob is silent, and before the brothers return home, Shem's father arrives.
Right.
Then Jacob's sons come home. And then Hamor starts speaking. So Jacob and his sons do not have an opportunity to discuss anything amongst themselves, according to the chronology.
I think that that's a very wise point, and I think that you're correct. In other words, there's no family powwow that occurs before the negotiation. In other words, Hamor is running over because he wants to take care of his son. His son is in love. Great. You know, for somebody who's watched Cinderella a lot of times in the last year or two. So, I mean, that's the prince's father, right? There's finally a moment. Go! You have to hurry up and do it. It's very much like that. So I think that you're right. I think your point is that Jacob and his sons never have the opportunity, at least not in the narrative, to have a closed door conversation first. This brings us to verse 8. Hamor spoke with them saying, "My son Shechem longs for your daughter. Please give her to him in marriage." In other words, he's speaking with them, but obviously who is he really talking to? He's talking to Jacob. Or is it the patriarch to patriarch thing? In other words, the fathers are busy trying to arrange the marriage. "Intermarry with us. Give your daughters to us and take our daughters for yourselves. Look, hey, let's make this the first of many. There's no reason why we have to limit this to my son. Let's make this a practice between us. Let's all integrate. You will dwell among us and the land will be open before you. Settle, move about and acquire holdings in it. This will be good for you. You'll integrate with the larger population here. You're a family. You'll become Canaanites like us. And we'll become one big happy family over here in Shechem." Okay. Verse 11. "Then Shechem said to her father and brothers, 'Do me this favor and I will pay whatever you tell me.'" Here you find out that Shechem showed up to be part of the negotiation also, right? He's saying, "Look, I'm really desperately in love with her. I really want to marry her." From the Department of Strange Midrashim, you should know that there are several rabbinic teachings that, believe it or not, invoke Shechem's love of Dinah as an ideal form of love. They don't approve of the rape part, but they actually buy that he, at this moment, really, really actually loves Dinah. And they actually talk about it in terms of the ideal form of a husband loving a wife. And even they invoke this with regard to the love between God and the people of Israel, saying that this passionate love that Shechem has right now is so absolute, that's the kind of love we should have in our marriages and that we should have between us and God. Amazingly enough, they're not blind to the context of this particular love, but they pluck out the love that Shechem feels toward Dinah, and they say, at least this is the real deal. It's actually a very genuine love relationship at this point. That being said, they're also outraged by the context of it. Yeah.
But he didn't know how much time has it become
changed
to know what
he is,
number one.
You're so 21st century. You're allowed to be skeptical. I'm just saying that there are midrashim that take him quite seriously. And by the way, there's reason to believe that he actually really is in love with her from the narrative itself. So we'll get there in just a moment. Yes. Myself, but from just think about the love at first sight concept. Just watch West Side Story, and that's said in what it's not 3,800 years ago. They see each other across the room, stars, you know, the whole thing. Great video effect, at least for an old movie, and you know you get the sense of there's a real attraction there, and it's quite genuine, right? Here, obviously, there's a lot more. There's intimacy, and so Shechem, again, it's not even half a day; it's within an hour. However long this whole episode takes, grabs her, rapes her, is in love with her, and then starts to actually talk very sweetly to her, hoping that he will melt her heart and make her realize that this is a good idea. So that's, you're right, it's very sudden. And from our point of view, we might pull Dinah aside and say, don't fall for this, not to mention the guy's a monster. Yes, I agree. But from the context that they're in, this might be her best option, and she might not have a whole lot of choice. The fact that they're turning this into a negotiation is something that the brothers are going to exploit. Hey guys, if you're going to talk to us as though it is a real negotiation, well then let's negotiate. And that's what comes up now, actually. Verse, I think I have to read 12 just to officially do it. Ask of me a bride price ever so high as well as gifts, and I will pay what you tell me. Give me only the maiden for a wife. So again, our sages buy into the idea that he really is crazy about her at this point. Verse 13. Jacob's sons answered Shechem and his father Hamor, speaking with guile because he had defiled their sister Dinah, and said to them, we cannot do this thing. I'm just going to stop for a moment here. Where's Jacob? Where'd he go? I thought he was the main negotiating man. After all, he's the father. The other guys are teenagers. I'll give you the mic.
I was wondering in the very beginning is, was he, when his sons make some judgments about their judgment, the opportunity to sit down and talk with them doesn't appear until afterward. So that's equally important in the sense that he sent his sons were back and moved on with the chose.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. And so to pull this point back, all of a sudden the brothers jump in and take over the negotiation, which means, of course, we get to hear their voices. We understand that they're already livid. And Jacob is completely back. So we don't know his mood in the first place. We don't know what he would have discussed with his sons had they ever had this conversation. And now he's not even talking to the negotiation. He's completely out of that picture. Say again?
We have all information that Hamor came, Shem's father came, and they're answering Hamor and Shem.
Well, Shem showed up in verse 11. In other words, that's where he peeks out.
Oh,
And you realize that he's already there. Now, as he came with his father, but from a negotiator's point of view, Hamor and Jacob are supposed to be the main guys. Right? So Shechem is there, holding his father's hand, or hiding, right, one, you know, is right there on the scene. So, but he's on the same level as the brothers in this. But all of a sudden, Hamor turns out to be negotiating with the brothers. This is critical. Now, this expression, speaking with guile, that we saw in verse 13, the Hebrew word is bimirma. There's only one other time in the whole book of Bereishit where this term bimirma appears. And that is when Jacob deceives his father. No, he deceives his father about Esav. In other words, he's pretending to be Esav, but he deceives Yitzchak. He deceives Isaac. He's dressed up with goat fuzz. He says that he's Esav, but he's not. I mean, he was wearing goat fuzz, but he was not Esav. He was Jacob. Fine. He used Mirma over there. And Isaac even said, Ba'achicha b'mirma, that your brother, he was talking to Esav at that moment, after everybody figures out everything, and says that your brother Jacob has come with guile. Now, Nechama Leibowitz argues that the word mirma is inherently negative. So whenever you hear that word, that's the Torah saying, this is bad. So from that point of view, Jacob did the wrong thing with the deceit, and now the brothers are doing the wrong thing by using deceit. Rabbi Elchanan Samet, we'll get back to in a little while, argues no. The term mirma is neutral. There was deceit involved, but it isn't a morally loaded term. And he argues that when the weaker party has no other option, that's what a weaker party might do. It's kind of like an ambush. Okay, it's deceitful, but the point there is to win the war. So Rabbi Samet does not think that Shimon and Levi or the other brothers did anything wrong here. And for that matter, he defends Jacob over with the deceit. He doesn't think that Jacob did anything wrong. And so that's an interesting debate. I'm going to stay out of the whether Mirma is positive or negative because there's simply not enough information. What I will tell you is this might be a psychological reason why Jacob can't ask. Thank you. This might be a psychological reason why Jacob cannot act here. Jacob is plagued by his deception, and he's going to be haunted by it for the rest of his life. He must have figured out the only way that I could possibly rescue Dinah is through a trick. We're not crack commandos. We're a family of shepherds, most of whom are underage. Right? How in the world are we going to pull this off? We can't fight them. We can't rescue. Okay, we have to come up with a trick. But I've already spent my trick in the book of Bereishit, and I'm going to be haunted by it for the rest of my life. It could be that Jacob acts passively in this whole story, in part because he can't do it. He feels bad about the fact that he was deceitful originally. And that leaves it to his own sons to come up with the plan that was obviously necessary. Another possibility, which some of you have raised, is that Jacob doesn't want to do anything because there is no prudent solution. He might feel terrible that Dinah has been raped and captured, but what in the world does he think we're going to do about it? He might just think, given the options of fighting when we'll all die, and then she's still stuck, or not fighting, okay, we have to give her up. He does the same thing, by the way, later on with a son of his, Shimon, who's the protagonist of this story. Joseph, when he was still incognito, he was still vice pharaoh and the brothers didn't know who he was, took Shimon captive. And he said, he's going to be in jail until you bring Benjamin down here. Well, Jacob's attitude was, well, I'm not going to gamble Benjamin for Shimon, so sorry. Meaning, in theory, had the famine ended, Shimon would have died in an Egyptian prison, and Joseph would have said, man, what's going on here? How come nobody's sending for him? But Jacob never would have sent Benjamin down there, had it not been for the fact that eventually Judah said, we're all going to die. So Jacob has a track record of being incredibly prudent, even at the life expense of his own children. Which you can like or not like about him, and that's something that we'll have to talk about. Okay, verse 14 again. And said to them, we cannot do this thing to give our sister to a man who is uncircumcised, for that is a disgrace among us. Only on this condition will we agree with you, that you will become like us in that every male among you is circumcised. Then we will give our daughters to you and take your daughters to ourselves, and we will dwell among you and become as one kindred. But if you will not listen to us and become circumcised, we will take our daughter and go. Notice how they say our daughter, even though, of course, it's really, in a technical sort of way, our sister. So they're speaking on Jacob's behalf. Jacob is silent the entire time he's silent over here. We still don't know his mood. But the brothers who have jumped in and taken over the whole thing, they realize that they're still speaking for their father. And you get that little glimpse of that over here. What do the brothers hope to do with this plan? The plan is, just to make sure we all get it, They tell all the menfolk of Shechem will have to circumcise themselves. And if you do this, then, okay, deal. Shechem can marry Dinah. We can marry your daughters. Everything is cool because we could be one integrated family under the covenant.
I think they're hoping they just say at that point, no thanks, and give her back.
Right, so plan A might be that they're figuring, okay, look, Shechem is desperate. He really wants to marry her. So he'll say, okay, Hamor is stuck, he's the dad, he'll have to go through with this also. But the townsfolk, when they hear this, are going to say, wait a second, you want us to do what? And they will decline. And then the deal is off. And then they rescued their sister through a negotiation. It could well be. Well, that's what I'm saying. What are the brothers thinking at this moment? It could well be that they're thinking, the people of Shechem will never accept these terms.
The last one is that we will take our daughter. No, not necessarily true. They can say, no, we have her, but we have to be circumcised.
Say that again?
They can say, we're keeping Dina, and we're not going to be circumcised. Let's get the negotiation going, or goodbye.
Meaning the people of Shechem could come back with that.
They have the upper hand.
Boy, oh boy, did they have the upper hand. But in other words, the brothers are taking advantage of the fact that that Shechem and Hamor are acting respectably right now. They're negotiating. In other words, they could just say, ha-ha, we have her, and what are you going to do about it? But they're actually coming and trying to appear to be Menches. So the brothers are like, okay, light bulb. They're pretending to be Menches. Let's take this for all they got. Let's make a Menschlich negotiation, which we think they're going to decline. And then they'll be stuck. They'll have to give her back.
They never have to accept either of these conditions.
I understand that. But they're actually trying to make a negotiation. And so that's what's going on over here. Yeah, last thing for now.
It's more like a threat. I agree with my friend here. They're saying, if you do not circumcise, we will go there, we will take off the body, which is clearly something they cannot do. So our question is, how can they have such response? How to say, we small few can take you out?
They're not threatening at all. They're saying, if you don't accept the circumcision deal, well then, no deal, and we want our sister back, or our daughter back, because they're speaking for Jacob. And that's a reasonable thing within a negotiation between equal parties. In other words, they're taking advantage of the fact that Shechem and Hamor are speaking as though it's a real negotiation. Verse 18. Their words pleased Hamor and Hamor's son Shechem, and the youth lost no time in doing the thing, for he wanted Jacob's daughter. Now he was the most respected in his father's house. So Hamor and his son Shechem went to the public place of their town and spoke to their fellow townsmen, saying, these people are our friends. Let them settle in the land and move about in it, for the land is large enough for them. We will take their daughters to ourselves as wives and give our daughters to them. Rashi already points out what brilliant negotiators these guys are. They're slimy, but they're great negotiators. To Jacob, they say how much it will benefit Jacob to make this deal, and to their townsfolk, they say how much it will benefit their townsfolk. So Rashi and later commentators already pick up on that. Verse 22, but only on this condition will the men agree with us to dwell among us and be as one kindred, that all our males become circumcised as they are circumcised. Their cattle and substance and all their beasts will be ours. In other words, it's worth it, guys. We could do this. We'll be in pain for a little while, and then bam, we'll get all their stuff. If we only agree to their terms so that they will settle among us. All who went out the gate of his town heeded Hamor and his son Shechem, and all males, all those who went out of the gate of his town were circumcised. So it worked. So going back to Sheldon's point, if the brothers had hoped that the family would decline, that the town would decline, well, now it's over. This is the point of no return. Once everybody's circumcised, they either have to honor the deal, or plan B, which is, okay, we don't want to really honor this deal. It could very well be, though, that the brothers expected that they would circumcise the menfolk, and the plan all along was what we then read about. We're never going to know the answer to that question. Right? In other words, we only know what happened.
But where's the dialogue if this were not the real plan?
Well, the plan is that what they were telling the people of Shechem isn't what they were planning on doing. In other words, either way, they didn't sincerely plan on integrating with the people of Shechem. That's the guile.
It doesn't seem like how it turned out was really the plan, because only two of the brothers.
Right.
Had it been the plan, you would have expected all of them.
Right. Very important point, that there's a division, which we're going to get to in just a moment, between Shimon and Levi, who are the protagonist brothers, and everybody else. There are other brothers in play as well. So here we go. Huh? Right, but even so, the question is, what are they going to do? You're right. It sounds like some conversations by now could have happened. It's no longer spur of the moment. That's a critical point. But we still just don't know. We have to read the text, and we'll see that there's a division made. Verse 25, on the third day when they were in pain, Shimon and Levi, two of Jacob's sons, brothers of Dinah, took each his sword, came upon the city unmolested, and slew all the males. They put Hamor and his son Shechem to the sword, took Dinah out of Shechem's house, and went away. The other sons of Jacob came upon the slain and plundered the town, because their sister had been defiled. So going back to your point, now that we've read it, the other brothers, why weren't they involved in the massacre part? It could be it was divide and conquer. It could be two guys can handle it. Or it could be that the other brothers didn't realize the killing part would happen. It could just be that they were expecting a rescue mission, because everybody's totally debilitated right now. And that's it. Not clear. But it does sound like these two brothers, Shimon and Levi, play a different role in the story. 28. They seized their flocks and their herds and asses and all that was inside the town and outside, all their wealth, all their children, all their wives, all that was in the houses, they took as captives and booty. Wow. That's a lot of stuff. Okay, so 30. Jacob said to Shimon and Levi, Jacob is going to talk. The whole story, he's been silent. And now suddenly Jacob is going to talk. Jacob said to Shimon and Levi, notice he doesn't speak to all the brothers either. You know, Shimon and Levi play some different role from the other brothers. You have brought trouble on me, making me odious among the inhabitants of the land, the Canaanites and the Perizzites. My men are few in number, so that if they unite against me and attack me, I and my house will be destroyed. But they answered, should our sister be treated like a whore? And they get the last word. What's Jacob's objection?
We made a deal.
What you're saying is very moral. But what's his objection? Yeah.
He's indignant.
It's a prudent matter. He's not arguing on moral grounds, right? He's saying, hey, we're still just the tiny family that we were before, and this might also give away why Jacob wasn't planning on doing anything. We're a small family. What in the world are we going to do against a town? Okay, fine. So congratulations. You came up with a very clever way of knocking off the menfolk here. But guess what? Shechem is part of a big Canaanite orbit. They have allies. You've imperiled our existence. He has no objection to the extent of the retribution or the plundering or any other thing that's happening over here, which doesn't mean he's not bothered by it, but he doesn't talk at all about we had a deal or, wow, a massacre? Really? There's not none of that. Okay.
Also, there's a sort of parallel to taking the women folk, presumably to be forcibly taken as wives or sell them as slaves or something, which is not a lot different than what Shechem did. So he's raising no ambiguity, but eventually they're going to sell these people as slaves and children, or they're taking them in. Effectively intermarrying, doing exactly what they said they were going to do, sans the men.
Correct. If they're marrying them, then it's a real problem. I imagine it's more of a slave situation because they're being treated as booty rather than as an integrated family. But it's a yucky story. I'm not taking away your general point, which is it's a yucky story. So now that we know that it's a yucky story, fine. We've finished the chapter, hooray, and we've had a great conversation about it. It's actually tough to do when it's a big room, but I'm happy that people felt free to participate. That's the way it's supposed to be. That's what learning is all about. Okay, now that we've learned it all together and we've all hashed out a bunch of important issues, so who does the Torah favor in this story? In other words, what would have been the right response? Or what are we supposed to learn from this?
Revenge isn't always good.
I definitely would agree with that. But the question is, what does this story say? And that's the tricky part. In other words, we all agree. What an awful story. Pretty much every detail of this story is pretty awful. Right? And I'm not trying to sugarcoat any of this stuff because there's really not a lot of sugar to be doing here. But, fine, it's horrible. But what does the Torah think is the right approach here? So let's just frame it in literary terms. Since it's the closing, they get the last word, the Torah is giving them a lot of weight. Okay.
Two things. One being when Jacob does that the others will unite against me and attack me, I and my house, and doesn't say us. He separates himself. And I just wanted to make that point of being perspective. And also the fact that basically two wrongs don't make a right. Yes, something terrible was done, and yes, something you could say, depending on what you believe, correct or incorrect, it was done in retribution, but there was no connecting.
Okay, good. A couple more things, yeah?
I'm afraid it worked. According to Jacob, there were no two wants. Basically, absolutely no comment that Jacob makes that, period. Doesn't condemn him for going out, doesn't condemn him for being raped, doesn't condemn him for coming back. Absolutely nothing.
I do not have the very spot of the beginning on this. I'll mention this now since you're mentioning it, then I'm going to forget to say it at the end, and we'll run out of time. The Talmud, this is one of these really cool moves. There are many cool moves that the Talmud makes, but the Talmud makes one awesomely cool move with regard to this story. When it talks about the book of Job, so there's Mrs. Job in that story who makes a cameo saying, Job, you're suffering so much, just curse God and die already. And Job blows her off and says, oh, what a faithless comment, get out of here. And then Job instead tirades for a long time. That's what happens over there. There's one Talmudic view that says that Mrs. Job was Dinah. Don't make any historical assessments based on that. In fact, the Talmud debates whether Job himself or the story existed at all. But what the Talmud is doing is giving Dinah a voice. Because after all, why did this happen? Look at all this terrible suffering, which is probably what she might be thinking in this story. But of course, she's never given a voice in the narrative because the story isn't about her. Even if we call it the Rape of Dinah, give it that title, or the Dinah narrative, because she starts the whole thing rolling. She's not the primary player in terms of the Torah's ongoing discussions. I think that your point is very poignant, but the Talmud tries to rescue a voice for her where it's totally absent in the text on all sides. Okay, last thing for now. Yeah.
Firstly, with that gentleman said that they got the punchline, and also from the fact that Jacob's argument is not from a moral standpoint, it's a pragmatic standpoint. It seems like perhaps
very good. Okay, so without my taking any side on any of this, I'm just going to go the way I'm going to take this journey in the next 7 minutes. Here comes a survey of the history of interpretation of this story. We'll start medieval, because that's always the classical place that any good rabbi is going to start. And several commentators do jump in and try to make an evaluation, starting with Rambam in his halakhic code, the Mishneh Torah, but also Rabbi Yitzchak Arama and Don Yitzchak Abarbanel living in 15th century Spain. And they all make the same points. They all say, yes, Shimon and Levi have the last words in the narrative. That matters. Abarbanel invokes chapter 35, which is right here on the page. I brought it here for the sake of Abarbanel. Right after the story, it says, God said to Jacob, arise, go up to Beit El and remain there, and build an altar there to the God who appeared to you when you were fleeing from your brother Esav. As they set out, here's the narrator jumping in, right, the narrative, a terror from God fell on the cities round about, so that they did not pursue the sons of Jacob. Here's the narrative chiming in and saying, Jacob, you were worried about the allies? God will protect the family of Israel from the allies of Shechem. Abarbanel says, you see, God is supporting Shimon and Levi. That's his argument. Let me just run with this for a little while. So Rambam, Rav Yitzchak Arama and Rav Dan Yitzchak Abarbanel all agree that Shimon and Levi acted properly. And the moral argument that they invoke is that every town from the creation of the universe is required by God's law not only to be moral, but to have a court system to impose justice on the land.
The Noahide laws.
The Noahide laws, correct. So, every society has its criminals. Every. What makes a society moral is if there are court systems that justly impose these rules. But in this case, the whole town knew about it, and they were all abuzz, and nobody did a thing. That makes the whole town guilty, says Rambam, Yitzchak Abarbanel, Yitzchak Arama. That's their view. And they bring support from within the narrative that there's no condemnation of their immorality, that Shimon and Levi get the last word. It's a very critical argument, a very important argument. One dissenting voice in all of this, which some of you have raised as well, is Ramban, Rabbi Moshe ben Nachman in 13th century Spain. He disagrees with these great, with his great antagonists in this debate. He says, wait a second here, folks. This is not all the Torah has to say about the story. We also have chapter 49, when Jacob is on his deathbed. And so I put that here for him. When Jacob is on his deathbed, he gives what we like to say are blessings to his sons. But not all of them are so blessing-y. Okay, including what he says to Shimon and Levi. Shimon and Levi are a pair. Their weapons are tools of lawlessness. Let not my person be included in their council. Let not my being be counted in their assembly. For when angry they slay men, and when pleased they maim oxen. Cursed be their anger so fierce, and their wrath so relentless. I will divide them in Jacob and scatter them in Israel. Well, well, well. A moral argument after all. And it's a big one. He's saying, this is a terrible thing that you have done. And it's presumed by all commentators on the map here that he's referring to the Shechem episode. Okay? And now he's saying what you did was wrong. He's not saying it wasn't prudent. That's what he said back at the time. Here it's a moral argument. And Ramban uses exactly your argument, by the way. He says, Yaakov felt that once the brothers put a deal out there and Shechem honored it, it was a betrayal of trust. Maybe the people of Shechem were sincere. And he was upset about that on moral grounds. So Ramban says, Jacob's blessings, you have to understand, are not just a father's opinions to his sons. Because then you could just say, okay, it's his opinion, but the Torah thinks otherwise, the Torah would win. Jacob's blessings are cast as prophetic. They're intended to be the patriarch's blessings to his children, and these blessings are going to be fulfilled. In fact, Jacob's curse to Shimon and Levi is that their tribes won't get parcels of land in the land of Israel, which of course is exactly what happened. Shimon's tribe did not get its own land. It was absorbed into the tribe of Judah. And the tribe of Levi was scattered throughout the country with cities. Neither one got a tribal inheritance the way that the other tribes did. Jacob is giving the program for what's actually going to happen. Okay, so Ramban says, absolutely not. We can't ignore chapter 49. It's a prophetic curse of the behavior of Shimon and Levi. So we have a very interesting debate here. The argument of Rambam, Rabbi Yitzchak Arama, Dan Yitzchak Abarbanel is all rooted in the primary narrative. And Ramban's argument is rooted in chapter 49. Meaning, they're debating different texts within the Torah. Okay, jump ahead to the 21st century and you get to Yeshivat Har Etzion's virtual Beit Midrash, where some of the best Torah in the world will be found. And lo and behold, because this is an important story to discuss, several rabbinic writers alive today and teaching in Israel today choose this story when they get to Parshat Vayishlach. So you can go to the archive and read the whole thing. Rabbi Elchanan Samet, who I mentioned earlier, he believes, if you just read chapter 34, he agrees with what we've all been saying. It sounds like Shimon and Levi get the last word. Jacob invokes no moral argument, and he thinks Jacob is wrong for remaining silent. His plan of passivity in the face of his daughter being raped is unacceptable. He says Shimon and Levi are the right protagonists in that story, and Jacob is the one who is overly passive. That's his argument. And along comes Rabbi Zev Whiteman in a different year in the virtual Beit Midrash, and says, hey, what about chapter 49? You'll start to see that we're going to be running in some circles. What about chapter 49? You can't ignore Jacob's curse. Jacob's curse is very clear. What they did was immoral, and it is a prophetic curse. And therefore, that should be decisive. And therefore, Shimon and Levi overreacted. And Jacob is a better way to go about it. Rabbi Amnon Bazak, another one in this saga, he actually tries to get around the problem because he sees that we have a circle going here. He says the problem isn't the massacre. He said the problem is the plunder. Going back to your point, actually. He says the massacre as a means for rescue was really their only recourse. They had no... Shechem wasn't going to give her up. But when they started taking stuff, that undermined the purity of motive that Shimon and Levi claimed. They say, oh, the purity of Israel is at stake. Well, wait a second here. Why'd you take all their things? That makes it sound like you were doing that for personal gain.
But they didn't think that their brothers did.
Right, so he says that was worse. Shimon and Levi, he argues, are pure. And the other brothers are actually the problem. Of course, that doesn't answer the fact that Jacob curses Shimon and Levi and leaves the other brothers alone. That's why Rabbi Bazak's argument, shaky, correct. Yeah?
What about the whole We're not supposed to do it. Yes. Okay, good.
Two things. I find the chapter 49 very disingenuous because when Jacob says, let not my person be included in our council, we will not include in your council, we will have chila. And now he's about to die. So what's the point of a statement like that? It's very disingenuous.
Well, I like your poetic reference to the fact that he wasn't part of their council originally. I imagine what he's saying more is, I don't want any part in what they've done. Right? I think that's how he's slanting.
As a poet, in the beginning, Hamor said, you can have over take your cattle, or you can enrich your money, blah, blah, blah. So they're sort of following what Hamor wants to.
Okay, a couple more things. Very good. Yeah, a couple more things.
This reminds me of a Syria conquering commission. This is divine judgment to do so, but then after a much later date, the Syria is destroyed.
Okay, so that's like
God uses the two evil brothers and then curses them later.
Cool analogy. It's a complicated one, but I'm not going to be able to sort that one through because then we have to talk about Assyria, which is another thing that gets me very upset, but not tonight. I want to get upset about this story tonight. Yeah. Okay, a couple last things.
Shem. Here's another time you didn't mention, which is also a defilement and a trigger, which is right before the brothers sell Joseph, they go by Shem. And so sort of, here's the leitmotif of, oh, we're going to tell Father one thing, but we're doing something else that's for our benefit.
Good observation, and several midrashim link the Shem's occurrences for negativity. Very good, and I like your particular thing about the deception. Okay, last thing, and I'm going to roll it through. Yeah.
Also, I heard John Nadowski got upset.
Oh, I didn't see him in the archive. Okay, carry on.
That this year is from the Bahrain, where Moshe is the longest bracha to Levi. Levi stood up and even killed other people in his family. Levi was the good guy. Levi was Aaron. And all of the people were wonderful, all the people. They get the biggest bracha. So, this is the conclusion of Levi is the good guy and becomes the person deserving the mosque for everything.
Right, so here I can give a whole shiur on that also. The one line bottom of this one, I don't know what Rav Meidan says, is that Levi proves that you could take the curse of Yaakov and turn it into something positive. In other words, he still ends up being scattered throughout Israel, but now is the teachers of Israel, because he's earned the spiritual class of the people because of his positive interaction at the golden calf. Where Shimon blows it at Baal Peor, so he keeps his curse negative. So I would give so that's the one line, you know, that's the 60th minute of a 60-minute shiur that would trace through the whole thing. So there you go. Getting over it, but so the observation is correct. I don't know what Rav Meidan himself says, but yeah, I think it's a critical point that Levi was able to take the curse of Yaakov and use the violence, at least for the side of good. Okay, good. So that all being said, So far we've failed in the medieval period to work things out because either you quote chapter 34 or you quote chapter 49. We failed in the 21st century for exactly the same reason. Swing it back to the Second Temple period. And lo and behold, you have the same thing going on over there. You have the fourth book of Maccabees written in the Second Temple period. They side with Jacob. They say that the lesson you're supposed to learn is that reason trumps over passionate anger. And they hail Jacob as being such a rational, even-tempered man, as opposed to the hot-headed sons of Yaakov. So the fourth book of Maccabees likes Jacob here. The book of Judith, and for that matter another book called the Testament of Levi, all books written in the Hellenistic period, they say the opposite. They celebrate Shimon and Levi for zealously defending the honor of Israel, for fighting for what was right, and they're upset with Yaakov for remaining silent. It's like when you have a crisis, you have to act. You can't do it. So lo and behold, as early as the Second Temple period, we were having the same circular debate, which carried over into the medieval period, which carried over into the modern period. And that brings us to why I think this is so. There is no right answer to the question. What would we want as justice here? Okay, think about this. To sneak in, maybe kill the rapist, rescue Dinah, have no further consequences at all. That would be fair. It would be just. But bottom line, it's impossible. So what are our options? There's either Jacob's total underreaction and submission to the disaster, or there's Shimon, Levi, and the brothers' overreaction by killing a lot more people. It's nice to try to justify by saying the whole town is now complicit by not executing justice. But Jacob didn't think so prophetically. Jacob thought this was an overreaction, and the Torah seems to indicate Jacob is right. This was too much for what is truly just. Okay, so we're stuck here. The Torah is setting out an impossible paradox where there's evil, and the evil has power. And now what do you do about it? You could either underreact or overreact. None of those are morally good answers. They're very complicated. So there's no solution, which is why we've been duking this out for thousands of years, and we cannot come to a solution. But what I would say is that if I were teaching in journalism school, this is the very first story I would teach. For the simple reason that it is a fair piece of journalism, which you very seldom see. The story sets out the facts the way that they are, meaning, had Shechem just asked Dinah out for a cup of coffee, the story never would have happened. The fact is that Shechem was evil, Hamor was willing to aid and abet the evil, and the town was willing to aid and abet the evil. That's fact number one. Now the family, Yaakov and his brother and his sons, are stuck because the only fair solution is impossible. You could either underreact or overreact. That's good journalism. If you just tell the story like that, when you're dealing with terrorism, or you're dealing with oppression, or you're dealing with corruption, and you just set it out that had the corrupt people or had the terrorists not been there, we have no story to tell. We'd have to print a news story about something that people don't buy newspapers for, right? You have the fact, you have the position that there's some evil out there. Now the question is, what is the proper response when there's no good response? That's a morally important question that all of us should be discussing all the time in the face of the evil that exists in this world. And that's why I think this story is so incredibly valuable. And the same thing is true with politicians, if even from the journalistic point of view. If the headline were Massacre at Shechem, that's the wrong headline. But that's what you would see. If politicians set things out by saying that there's a cycle here. First, Shechem and Hamor were bad, and then Jacob and the sons were bad. That might all be true, but it isn't a cycle. There was a start, and before that start, nothing would have happened. And if you can keep the moral clarity that the Torah is trying to set out, then at least we've gained something from this otherwise awful story. And I think that's why it's so valuable. Our discussions here tonight were fantastic. The discussions in the Second Temple period, you see that already then, they weren't writing systematic commentaries. They were writing stories, but those stories were trying to derive, what is the Torah trying to teach? And everybody was able to derive a different message. In the medieval period, where they are writing systematic commentaries, still couldn't solve this one. 21st century, my goodness, we have so much literary technique at our disposal and we're using it, but we still, bottom line, come down to the same conclusions. Now, some people are going to focus exclusively on chapter 34, where Shimon and Levi get the last word, Jacob underreacts, and the fact that Jacob has then a prophetic curse of Shimon and Levi. But it's a fabulous instance of truth-telling in morally impossible situations. We hope and pray that there won't be morally impossible situations forever. We hope that at some point, evil will just stop being evil, and then suddenly there won't be a story to tell. But as long as people talk about it in terms of cycles, or in terms of distorting the headlines, and equating the victims to the aggressors, well, then it's hard to see our way out of that. We hope and pray that the world will gain the moral clarity that the Torah is trying to teach. On that happy note, I thank you all so much for coming. It's really been inspiring. I again want to thank the Institute for Jewish Ideas and Ideals for co-sponsoring the event with KJ. And before you go, underneath table number one and underneath table number three, those lumpy things that are underneath the tablecloths may well be delicious stuff. Please feel free to enjoy it and enjoy your evening.